Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome to episode 230 of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. My name is Brian Salvatore, and thank you, as always, for joining us. This week is our offensive preview for the season, and we're going to not waste too much time, but get right into it. Chris McShane and I answer a couple emails and then talk about the Mets offense in regard and sort of position by position offense in regards to the NL East. So enjoy. All right, Chris, we're going to start off with an email we have today. As always, you can email the show at podcast@amazingavenueaudio.com. This is from Jonathan, and I'm going to skip the nice preamble where he talks nice things about us. Do you think it is absolutely necessary to win now, the next two seasons, due to Atlanta, Philly, and Miami seemingly on the track to rebuild and maybe very good in just two or three seasons? Or rather, do you think the Mets are in a position to sustain themselves as perennial playoff contenders beyond the 2018 season and go into every season duking it out with all four teams in the NL East? If you had to choose one of the two scenarios, which would you pick? The Mets being in the World Series for 2017 and 2018 with a chance to win the title, knowing that if they would win, it would take them out of the playoffs for the next eight seasons up through the 2026 season, or the Mets being in the position to just make the playoffs, not knowing how far they go, they may go in the playoffs for the next 10 seasons. But you will know they'll be above 500 every season and in contention to make the playoffs for all 10 seasons. So because we're going to do an offensive preview, this is kind of a fun place to start. Just thinking about, you know, how the team is built and what the future looks like. Do you have a strong opinion on this, Chris?
Well, my first strong opinion is that I don't think Miami is on track to do anything right.
That is probably true. Although they might have a new owner very soon, so maybe they could be.
No, that's true. But just obviously Giancarlo Stanton is a generational talent. And obviously, the tragic loss of Jose Fernandez sets them back from a baseball perspective. But the farm system that they have in place is consistently rated very poorly by just about everyone. We've seen teams turn it around faster than average, I would say. So depending on how they go about what they do with ownership and if that officially changes and what happens in the front office and everything, maybe. But, Atlanta and Philadelphia looked like teams right now that could be good sooner.
Yeah.
And I would say the Nationals' success is not guaranteed to continue forever. By the time Atlanta and Philadelphia are really good, Bryce Harper might not be a National.
I would say it's more it's likely Bryce Harper's not a National at that point.
Yeah, and Daniel Murphy, even if he continues what he did last year, he might be coming down. Scherzer is outstanding, so, I would hate it if fans of other teams started saying that Jacob deGrom was going to be bad as soon as he turned 30. So I don't want to say that because I don't think it's fair. But I don't know that there will be a time. Maybe there will be that there are four or five teams in the division who can contend not just for the title but maybe the first and second wild card spots. All that being said, I think the philosophical end of this, I need one World Series. I think I would still say if I could guarantee one or the other, making the next two World Series but not being sure what happens, or making the playoffs 10 more seasons in a row, I think I'm
being in the position to make the playoffs. Not making it for 10 years, but being in the position to make it.
Yeah, but like really legitimately contending. I think, philosophically, I think I would go with always contending just because you never know what happens in a playoff run.
Well, that's sort of my position as well. But do you have anything else to say before I steamroll this?
No, just like I want a World Series. I want one that I have a memory for.
That's interesting. I didn't consider that. If it was guaranteed a World Series and then not the playoffs for eight seasons, I'd be more tempted. But I think, from our generation, the sort of example here is the Braves in the 90s. right? The Braves made it to the World Series a number of times, only won one time, but were consistently good for a plus, right? They were exciting to watch. They were they had, you know, once in a generation talent. It was super exciting to be a Braves fan for that time. And I think I would really relish that as a Mets fan. Now, I also recognize it'll be frustrating to be in the wilderness if they don't win, you know, for every offseason would hurt like this, that these past two off seasons have hurt. And I don't know if my body's built for that. you know, but I think I would rather roll the dice on them being consistently good for 10 years. Because, I mean, think about this past year, right? This team was good. It wasn't great. But because they were in a position to contend and they were able to make, you know, perhaps an ill-conceived trade, but they were in a position to make a trade at the deadline, they were able to make it into the playoffs in a year they probably shouldn't have made it into the playoffs. And I think that if a team is consistently good enough, there might be those years when it's a heartbreaker and your good team doesn't make the playoffs. But I think just being consistently good, it's easier to sneak into the playoffs than... It's easier to sneak into the playoffs and go far in baseball that I would... I think I'd still go with 10 years. 10 years of playoff contention.
Yeah. I hate to put it this way, but perhaps Jeff Wilpon was onto something with meaningful games in September.
Oh, boy.
That shouldn't be the goal. But it's sort of, you know, it's an infamous line, right? But
he's not incorrect.
Right. That concept, having actually had it play out now for the last 2 years. Although in 2015, it was only a little bit of September because the Mets just ran away from the Nationals.
Right, yeah.
I would like those kinds of non-meaningful games in September.
Yeah. Laughers in September.
But yeah, no, it's a lot nicer. Even last year with the context of everything that happened with the team, it's a lot nicer to talk to a friend and say, hey, it looks like they might clinch in Philadelphia in September. You know, let's drive down, go see it, and have it work out. You know, that's a lot better than going, I'm going to get like $5 after the StubHub fee on this ticket for my ticket plan that I have left
right
on a Saturday in September. You know, so yeah, it's funny. I mean, strictly probability-wise, I suppose, you know, getting one World Series is more likely if you know you're in it in back-to-back years. But it kind of feels like 10 years of being around and contending would give you at least as good of an opportunity for one.
The way I would just think of it is simply that, you know, some years you're going to run into a buzzsaw of a team, like the 2016 Cubs, right? But some years you're gonna go against, I think it was in 04 or 05, the Padres made the playoffs with a losing record from the NL West.
Yes.
Like, you know, some years you're going to wind up against that team, and then you're in the championship series, and maybe you're the Mets from 06 and Pedro gets hurt and can't pitch in the championship series. You know, so you just never know what's going to happen in a playoff series. So I would rather position myself to be in that place where a lucky or a bad break one way or the other could really influence the playoff series than to just know I'm going to get there twice. Because we've seen teams lose 2 years in a row in the World Series. It happens.
Yeah, it does. You know, it's not just the Super Bowls from the early 90s.
Yeah, man, the Bills and the Braves make a really interesting parallel when you talk about them together.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're going to talk about the offensive makeup of the Mets for the next, you know, little bit of time here. Sort of preview the season offensively. And I have an exercise that I want to run through with you in a bit. But first, I want to hear your general offensive thoughts on the Mets in 2017. Are you feeling relatively good about them as an offensive unit? Do you have concerns? And if so, where do you have those concerns, Chris?
I would say yes, I'm feeling relatively good. going into last season, I thought that they would maybe be a top 10 team in baseball in runs per game. That did not happen.
No, it didn't.
But I would say I'll temper my expectations a little bit and say top half of baseball. So, you know, 15th or better. And that's, you know, that's not necessarily spectacular, but with the pitching they have, that should be good enough.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately, I mean, I love Yoenis Cespedes, and I would not be surprised if he has his best year. I mean, he's been excellent the last 2 years. I wouldn't be surprised if he surpasses that in any given season. I don't expect him to turn into Mike Trout or Paul Goldschmidt. You know, I mean, that upper tier of overall hitter. Like Cespedes is perfect for the Mets. Everything's clicked. And you can have him be the centerpiece of your offense, and it's fine. It's not a knock on him at all. But just comparing, you know, you don't have a guy who, as of yet, would maybe be the best hitter in baseball on this roster, but the bottom end is pretty good. Even with David Wright starting the season on the shelf, you know,
starting the season.
Hey, you know me. You know where I stand.
I know. I'm just teasing you. I just think it's fun at this point to make you be as optimistic as possible in all situations.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the National League implements the designated hitter. I've sold out all of my principles about baseball.
Me too, pal.
Hopefully they do it next week.
Yeah.
But it's sort of this idea. You know, you look at the potential opening day lineup, and I think as we're recording, the recent spring training lineups were probably pretty similar to it. And I think it was Reyes, Cabrera, Cespedes, and then some combination of everybody else, you know, Walker, Bruce.
Granderson.
Right. Granderson, Duda, Darnell. Barring a catastrophic year from Darnell again, there's not anybody there who's terrible. You know, there's not an easy out. So you might have, I mean, even when you look at the stats from last year, you have a bunch of guys who are above average, you know, not by a ton, but you go up and down the lineup and there's no picnic, so to speak.
Right.
So I guess that's my cause for optimism, is that, you know, you might have some regression from some of the veteran players on this roster who did really well last year. You know, some of that might be made up for by others, whether it be Darnell or Duda, just being a little bit more like what they had been
right
before their injured 2016 campaigns. So, yeah, I guess that's sort of my overall look at it. I expect an average to slightly above average offense. You know, if things go exceedingly well, great. And if I think the bottoming out would be somewhere, you know, slightly below average in terms of runs per game. And it's always within the National League is always a little bit better, at least for comparison's sake, just because the leagues have, you know, different rules.
Right.
That affect offensive output. So,
yeah. I agree with that. I think worst case scenario, they are a slightly below league average offense. Just for all the reasons you mentioned, you know, if Duda is healthy and if Darnell is healthy, and, you know, Darnell just doesn't have the absolute disaster of a year that he had last year, I think, you know, realistically, like you said, there's not really an easy out anywhere up and down the lineup. It's certainly not a lineup that a great pitcher couldn't shut down, but it seems like the type of lineup that there's enough talent there that you're not going to see the 2010, 2011 teams when just when a hit by pitch was celebrated, right? Because somebody was on base.
Like right.
That's just not going to happen this year. So I feel generally pretty good about the offense. And I think that, you know, if I'm putting on my Chris McShane mask here for a second, I think if everything clicks for them, they have a potential to really run away with the division, if everything clicks for them on both sides of the ball, which is never going to happen, but, you know, let's pretend for a second here that Walker and Cabrera are as good as they were last year and a little bit healthier. Let's say that Duda reverts back to his 2014-2015 line. Let's hope that Travis d'Arnaud is the catcher he was the second half of 2016. And all of a sudden, even if Granderson and Cespedes and Bruce are all just their average selves, you're looking at an excellent lineup. If Cespedes continues to love playing in New York and hit like, you know, like he's going for the MVP, and, you know, he said he wants to be the MVP this year, if those type of things happen, the team really has a potential to put together some high scoring games and some consistently high scoring games. I don't necessarily think all that's going to go right, but I think the potential is there, and I feel pretty good about the Mets' offense. Now, the exercise I'm going to do with you, Chris, is I have pulled up depth charts for all of the NL East for this season.
All right.
We're going to go through just position by position. I'm going to give you all of the blank position players, and you're going to rank the top three for me.
Okay.
Got it?
Yeah, I'm up for a game.
All right, let's start with first base. So, Lucas Duda.
Right.
Obviously. Ryan Zimmerman for the Nationals.
Yep.
Let's see. Tommy Joseph for the Phillies.
All right.
Justin Bour for the Marlins. And Freddie Freeman for the Braves.
So, Freeman is one.
Yes.
A very bold statement there by me.
Yeah.
So Freeman won. I just don't. Zimmerman five. Those two I know.
Yes.
So I've established the top and bottom of these rankings. I'm maybe a little bit of a homer here, but I would go Duda, Bor, Joseph.
Yeah, I think I do the exact same thing.
You know, it's the fact that Duda's, you know, done what he's done, just played, been healthy, that kind of stuff, through spring training to this point. That's plenty to like for me.
Yeah.
So.
All right, let's move on to second base. So we have Neil Walker for the Mets, Daniel Murphy for the Nationals, Cesar Hernandez for the Phillies, D. Gordon for the Marlins, and Brandon Phillips for the Braves.
All right, so Murphy won, despite our previous conversations about,
yes,
who would have the better season. I did consistently say during those that the smart money would be taking him. So Murphy won, Walker two. I think I don't D. Gordon is so overrated.
Yes, he is. But so was Brandon Phillips.
Yes, but in 2017, I'm taking D. Gordon over Phillips.
Yes.
And I might even take Cesar Hernandez over him. I don't know. That might be a little bit bold. Let me at least, I'm trying to do this mostly off my top of my head, but let me at least get some facts in front,
sure,
of me.
Sure.
Yeah, screw it. I'll take Hernandez over. I'm putting Phillips fifth.
I actually have the exact same rankings you do.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Brandon Phillips, for his anti-sabermetric stance, will always be a least favorite player of mine. But especially compared with these other guys, he's just, and in 2017.
Phillips had such a weird, like, public persona. When Twitter was new, a kid tweeted at him, and he, like, went to his Little League game, and he did all this stuff where he was, like, this down-to-earth, you know, like,
he's not, man of the people.
Right. And then it turns into, like, a reporter says something about his on-base percentage and he calls him fat. Like, it's like, what? Like, I don't know. There's a big turn there. And that, I think, factors into the tiebreaker there for me.
Yeah. All right, let's move over to shortstop. Obviously, the Mets have Asdrubal Cabrera. We got Trey Turner in Washington. We have Freddie Galvis in Philly. We have Danny Echevarria in Miami, and Dansby Swanson in Atlanta. And remember, we're talking about this season. We're not talking about who you would draft for your team, knowing in the future. We're talking about in 2017, who do you like?
So, Turner won.
Yep. I know.
This might sound terrible in 6 months, but I'm going as Dribble 2, Swanson 3, and then the other two, Hechevarria 5, and who's left? Galvius?
Galvius, yeah.
Yeah, no, I guess I'd go Galvius 4 and Hechevarria 5.
I think I would swap 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 on your list.
Okay. I know I'm, saying something negative about one of the darling prospects of baseball right now.
No, but I'm not saying that you're, I don't think you're being crazy.
Right. It's...
You're not saying Freddie Freeman's the fifth worst first baseman in the division,
Right, right.
All right, third base.
David Wright won. But in the next division.
They actually, according to the ESPN depth chart, they have Jose Reyes as the first in line. And I guess because he'll be the opening day third baseman, we'll go with Reyes for now.
Right, yeah, no, that's fair.
So Jose Reyes for the Mets, Anthony Rendon for the Nationals, Mikhail Franco for the Phillies, Martin Prado for the Marlins. I always forget he's a Marlin. And Adonis Garcia for the Braves.
So, let's see. Franco. Yeah. One. I like Prado a lot, but...
I don't know if I like him at third base a lot. I like him as the super sub guy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So, Franco one. I'll give Rendon a slight edge, even though, despite all the promise, he has yet to really prove it and put it together in the big leagues. But I will give him a slight edge there. Two, Reyes, three, Prado, four, and who's left? Five.
Garcia.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... And I will say that I think the difference is from two to four there. Mm-hmm. I would expect to be fairly small.
Yes, agreed. Agreed. It's a top-heavy discussion.
Yeah.
All right, let's write out the infield catcher here. We'll go in reverse order. Tyler Flowers is the first-line catcher for the Braves.
I remember I wrote about him as a potential backup for the Mets, and people were like, no.
Yep.
Why did you guys even write this guy up?
JT Realmuto for the Marlins. Cameron Rupp for the Phillies, Matt Wieters for the Nationals, and of course our pal Travis d'Arnaud for the Mets.
All right, so this is where I go out on a limb. I'm going to put d'Arnaud 1, Realmuto 2, Wieters 3, Rupp 4, and Flowers a distant 5.
Okay. I think if we're just talking about 2017, it changes the conversation slightly. I think I might still put Wieters 1.
Yeah, I don't know.
Just don't know. It's so hard to make a call about that guy.
Yeah, I mean, I hope I'm right. for the Mets' sake.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm just, you take him out of Camden, where his offensive numbers weren't even that impressive over the last year or two, and... Yeah, I don't know.
I guess he has the most consistent track record.
Yeah, he does. Realmuto is a guy who I didn't really buy, but I'm still, for the sake of this exercise, putting him high up.
That's fair.
Yeah, if Matt Wieters could just be terrible, please, for the next 2 years.
Yeah, I'm cool with that, too.
Like, if he could just be a sinkhole who balances out however great Bryce Harper is for his remaining time with the Nationals, then... We will be happy.
All right, left field. Here's where the Mets start looking pretty good. Left field for the Mets, obviously, Yoenis Cespedes. Jason Wirth for the Nationals. Howie Kendrick. That looks so weird. For the Phillies. Marcell Ozuna for the Marlins. And Matt Kemp for the Braves.
Man. Obviously, Cespedes is one.
Yes.
What are the other four? Kemp,
Wirth, Ozuna, and Howie Kendrick.
All right, so I Ozuna 2 for me.
Wirth 3?
I don't know.
Or Kemp.
Yeah, I'd go Kemp. with a my disclaimer is that there's a gap for me between Cespedes and Ozuna.
Yes.
And it's a much bigger one between Ozuna and the rest.
Yes. And Howie Kendrick is definitely the last there.
Yeah, I'd go Kemp. Kemp, Worth, and then Kendrick. Yeah.
All right. For center field, we have Atlanta with Ender Inciarte.
Right.
Christian Yelich for Miami.
Mm-hmm.
Odubel Herrera for the Phillies. It is Odubel, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because there are so many Herreras in baseball right now, I get confused sometimes. Adam Eaton for the Nationals, and Curtis Granderson for the Mets.
I think this is where it gets maybe the most interesting. There's stuff to like with everybody. I actually think I'd go Yelich 1, Eaton 2. I'm going to say Granderson 3, and then...
Herrera?
I would lean Odubel. But Inciarte, to me, is a guy... I get why people liked that he came over as part of that trade.
Yes.
But it's sort of like Rendon without the pedigree of, you know, that prospect. And maybe I'm just forgetting when he was a prospect.
No, I agree with that. I also think it's different when you're looking at a player the way we're looking at players right now. Just not how he makes up the part of his team, but how he goes against people in the division.
Right.
Like, so I think Inciarte has a lot of value on that team, but when put up against, you know, Christian Yelich, it doesn't seem like that.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, that's that works for me.
Okay. Last one. We kind of flew through these. Jay Bruce in right for the Mets, although I would like it to be Conforto. It's going to be Bruce. Jay Bruce in right field. Bryce Harper for the Nationals. Michael Saunders for the Phillies.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah. Giancarlo Stanton for the Marlins. And Nick Markakis for the Braves.
Okay. So...
that Phillies outfield is weird, man.
It is. So, yeah, I would... I'm going to go a little... I'm going Stanton 1. Harper 2.
Oof, I don't know about that.
Oh, no, it's...
I can't decide.
I know, but it's...
it's just you like Stanton more.
Yeah, and I'm not a Harper hater. I would love him to be on the Mets 2 years from today. It's not that. You know, it's just... I guess it's a question of, like, who will be better, not who do you want on your roster.
That's fair. Okay, yep. Yep.
Because Stanton's never been healthy when the playoffs start.
Right.
Which hasn't mattered because he's on the Marlins.
Right, right.
But, yeah, strictly in the sense of, you know, who looks best on paper for what they did this year. And I think Harper is the real deal. You know, I don't know if he ever repeats that MVP season quite to that level.
Right.
So not a knock on him at all. It's just, did you see Giancarlo's home run in the World Baseball Classic?
Of course I did. By the way, congrats Team USA. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun.
Okay, so you're saying Stanton 1, Harper 2.
Yeah.
Do you go Bruce 3?
Well, Bruce Saunders and who's the fifth that's left?
Markakis.
Markakis is 5, I know that.
Yes.
And some people might try to come and argue that Bruce is worse than him.
No, that they're wrong. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I'll take, if you want to call them empty home runs, I would take those yeah. over what Markakis does.
Absolutely.
It's Bruce and Saunders. Saunders was a guy who I felt like in the middle of last summer, you know, he was the sort of hot commodity in fantasy baseball that, you know, he's putting up unexpectedly good numbers, hitting home runs, that kind of thing. And he could do that in Philly.
He could.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to put Bruce the lowest of any of my Mets that I'm ranking here. I'll say Saunders 3, Bruce 4, Markakis 5.
Wow.
And I'm contemplating a Bruce Scherzi just to partly mess with people.
Of course you are.
I mean, I had somebody actually like insult me for wearing a Kadir jersey once in a men's room at Citi Field. So, I mean, it was by design. So, that was sort of the intended response.
You should have like a Job Bluth like thing of lighter fluid up your sleeve when you're wearing a Kadire jersey, just to go with the whole
Yes.
magician theme, you know, or illusionist
Oh,
rather.
yeah.
Sorry, illusionist.
Right.
All right. Real quickly, you might notice we did not mention our pal Juan Lagares because he is not going to be starting for the Mets this year. But we had an email question about him from our friend Andy. He said, "I was wondering what you guys think about Juan Lagares' contract extension with the Mets. It was thought to be a good move for both parties when signed, but criticized because of a dip in Lagares' performance over the last couple of years. Looking at the recent extensions for players like Ender Inciarte, Odubel Herrera, and Kevin Kiermaier, I can never pronounce that name properly. Juan's deal is looking a lot better to me. Thanks. What do you think about the deal, Chris?"
Well, it's certainly at a low point right now, just because of, the combination of what Lagares has done himself and what what the context of the outfield is with everybody else. It would be nice. Yeah, I don't think it's albatrossy, it's what's left. It's 4.5 million this year, 6.5. And then 9 in 19. So this year and next, I think those salaries are pretty okay. And then the one year where, say the bat never comes around, or that it remains that he's kind of a like short side of a platoon guy as an offensive player. That 2019, that might sting. So, but that's only one year of a salary like that. So, yeah, it's, I don't know. I don't think we're really going to find out this year either.
Well,
But
that was going to be my point was that I think you really need to have him start to find out how bad that contract is. If you don't
yeah.
start him, it's a bad contract.
Well, yeah, no, that is true. After this season, and who knows how things play out, Lagares himself has not stayed the healthiest of the outfielders. If a situation arises that he plays a lot more than we're all expecting at this point, then that could be a little bit more of a litmus test. But after this season, when the Mets have Granderson and Bruce due for free agency, and you move into 2018 with corners of Cespedes and Conforto, they'll have to make a decision about whether Lagares is the primary guy in center field. And then I guess take it from there. I mean, I get the overall point that some guys who, Kiermaier is much more defense first. And I mean, that's not really a knock on the other two, Inciarte and Herrera, in terms of their defense, just the one whose skill set I think probably is most similar to Lagares, even though he's been a little bit better as a hitter. I don't know. I don't love it, but I don't think it would be nice. And the Mets have spent more money on payroll the last couple of years. It would be nice if it really turned out that it was $9 million and nobody wanted it in 2019. If the Mets' payroll was such that we didn't really care about it either.
I think that if he plays every day next season in 2018, you know, if we're looking at an outfield of Cespedes, Lagares, and Conforto, I think that he can have a lot of value in just covering for some of the other two guys, maybe lack of defensive prowess in the outfield. And if he can hit just a little bit, I think that if with a team that has potentially a Neil Walker still at second base, who's maybe now having Amed Rosario at short, I think you might, and if especially if D'Arnaud and Duda, well, Duda, you know, is a question mark for the just for everything, but if D'Arnaud can hit a little bit too, then all of a sudden you can carry a Juan Lagares and not worry too much about his bat.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Well, we'll be back next week with a pitching preview. But again, we mentioned it real quickly. Just for you, Chris, what was the highlight of the World Baseball Classic?
I think it was that Giancarlo home run. I don't know. Insane. I mean, there was every spring he comes around and reminds us, like, oh, yeah, hey, everyone, this is a thing I can do. And it, for a division rival, he's a player who I very much appreciate. It probably helps that the Marlins have been bad. But yeah, that home run was great. And then aside from that, it's tough to pick one other moment. There were so many good games, and they were close, and I didn't see 100% of every game. But I think the highlight for me was just sort of the atmosphere, the, you know, the international feel of both the actual game on the field and the crowd that was supporting it, especially in Miami. So
yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. Is that sort of my highlight was just how much fun it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and these guys sound simple and silly, but it was so much fun.
Right. And you could tell these guys care. And that is, it's enjoyable to watch. It beats spring training exhibition games by a lot.
That is absolutely true.
Hey, everyone. This is Steve Saipa here. Going to be talking about the World Baseball Classic again. And now that it's over, literally minutes have passed since the World Baseball Classic ended, and I'm recording right now. Tell me that that wasn't exciting. Please, tell me that spring training is more important. Tell me that it's stupid that players are recklessly playing in the World Baseball Classic. Tell me it's stupid artificial competition that doesn't matter, whatever. I don't know about you, but seeing the players on the field, listening to all the chants in the stands, listening to the Oendens in the stands, just, I think that the tournament as a whole was pretty fun. So let's talk about those semifinal games. They were both nail-biters in two different ways. The game between Puerto Rico and the Netherlands had constant action, and the two teams went back and forth, and it's unfortunate that that stupid start with two men on base rule went into effect in the 11th, because, you know, the tournament isn't exactly built to handle games going deep into extra innings, but it would have been a lot more exciting to see what would happen if the two teams could have just kept playing rather than, you know, both making a concentrated effort to just basically bunt that man from second over to third and then just get a sac fly to end it. And speaking of bunts, what a great way to segue to the USA versus Japan game. That was an intense game. Also, with Tanner Roark and Tomo Sugano having a great pitcher's duel, Ryosuke Kikuchi let the U.S. score in the first run of the game in the fourth, and that was pretty out of character for him, because he really is by far the best shortstop in Japan. I mean, he has 4 Golden Glove Awards, one for every season that he's played so far. But, you know, what he giveth, he can also taketh away. And he went oppo in the sixth to tie it 1-1, which is also a little unexpected of him, because he's, you know, he's not really a power guy to begin with, and his power is pretty much mostly to his pull side, so going opposite field is a little unexpected. And Nobuhiro Matsuda bobbled the ball in the top of the eighth and let the U.S. regain the lead. And in the bottom of that inning, Yoshitomo Tsutsugo, I thought he tied it with a very, very loud fly ball to right field that Matt Verskergian and the cameraman really, really hyped up. But it was in play. It was caught. And that was that. Japan went down 1-2-3 against Gregerson. And surprisingly, to me anyway, Japan was eliminated. And after those two semifinals, really, the final was just a little bit of a letdown. I mean, no offense to them, but it seemed to me that Puerto Rico had no chance. And then, sure enough, they got shut out in pretty much a blowout game. Seth Lugo's day of reckoning finally came. But 7 strikeouts isn't too shabby. You know, he's really been a revelation. Every player on Team USA got on base at least twice, which I think might be a record for the World Baseball Classic, I don't know. But one thing is, I wish that David Wright was healthy enough to have been on this Team USA this year and get that win. You know, I've always thought that the Dark Knight was kind of a stupid nickname for Matt Harvey. You know, I'm not the biggest Harvey fan to begin with, but I always thought it was kind of dumb. But Captain America for David, you know, he's my favorite Mets player, pretty much. And Captain America is my favorite superhero, pretty much. And, you know, it was just always a good nickname. And the fact that David is always kind of this shining beacon in the darkness for the Mets. And, you know, Captain America has always been this kind of shining beacon of all those good American values and whatever else, you know, it just fits. So it would have been great for David to have been on the field to celebrate with Team USA. But, you know, hopefully he's able to be on the field in October or November, whenever it is, when the Mets get that ring. And, you know, that'll be equally great. So anyway, one of the main reasons that the MLB kind of organized the World Baseball Classic is to increase interest of baseball abroad. And if you kind of want to be a colonialist about it, you know, it's really they're interested in increasing MLB's market share abroad, where they're competing with, you know, local leagues and other international competitions and everything else. But, you know, just being naive about it, yeah, I hope interest in baseball abroad increases. I mean, and just look at China and India alone. That's 2.6 billion people. That's almost 40% of the entire world's population. 40%. You know, China's baseball program is fledgling, and in India, it's non-existent. But, I mean, imagine in 10, 20 years, when there's a viable baseball program in leagues in both of those countries, and you have 2.6 billion more potential baseball players out there, you know, that can only help baseball as a sport and, you know, the MLB, if those players eventually come to the United States to play. And while I'm not interested in MLB owners making more money off those guys, you know, as long as they can increase the interest and excitement that I have watching baseball, you know, that's the main thing. And I hope that the inverse is true, too. I hope that because of the World Baseball Classic, more people in the U.S. become interested in baseball abroad. You know, the fact that the U.S. won the championship now, it's going to reinforce that whole, you know, Americans play the best baseball thing, and maybe that's true. But even with that being the case, I hope there were people out there who, you know, were like, wow, that 0-10 thing was pretty cool. You know, maybe I'm going to go on YouTube and watch some more Japanese baseball. I hope people are like, wow, it's pretty cool how players on these Caribbean teams really wore their emotions on their sleeves. Maybe next year I'll watch the Caribbean series. That'll be pretty cool, you know? Just expanding people's horizons. You know, baseball is... I like baseball as a sport, as a thing, not just as a person that likes the Mets, you know? So it would be cool if there are more people out there that can increase their enjoyment of just baseball as a pastime, as a thing, you know? So with that in mind, and I'm kind of going over stuff I've mentioned, you know, in weeks past or whatever, but for anyone, you know, I'll repeat myself, for anyone who suddenly has become aware and interested in some of the leagues outside of the MLB, I just want to kind of go over some of the top guys to pay attention to. You know, 10 of the top guys that played in the World Baseball Classic and play in other leagues. It's going to be a list that's pretty Cuba and Japan heavy because Korea didn't exactly assemble its best World Baseball Classic squad. The best talent in Taiwan didn't participate for reasons that I've mentioned last week and in the past. And even if they did, it's a little questionable if even their best players kind of would be on a top 10 World Baseball Classic guys to pay attention to list. And then some of the more talented guys, most of the talented guys on other teams, you know, all those Caribbean teams and Italy, Australia, most of those guys are either former MLB players or are still affiliated with MLB teams. So with that in mind, here are those 10 top World Baseball Classic guys to pay attention to in other leagues. Number one is Victor Mesa Jr., and he's the son of Victor Mesa, who is a Cuban star, and he used to manage the Cuban national team. He's one of the more dynamic players in Cuba today, and he just had a breakout season last year where he hit 354, 399, 539 in 70 games with the Cocodrilos de Matanzas. And he's pretty much has five-tool potential. He's a good hitter. He has power. He has a strong arm. He is a plus-plus runner and a plus defensive center fielder. Next up, number two, is Yelky Cespedes, who, much like Victor Mesa, is coming off of a breakout season where he hit 321, 376, 526 with the Alazanes de Granma. And he's also considered a 5-2 outfielder. He really hasn't shown too much power just yet. But, I mean, he has the same baseball genes that his half-brother does, so you know that it's coming. And outside of that, though, he has shown the ability to hit for average. He's very fast, and he has the Cespedes arm and the family eyebrows. So, number three is Alfredo Despaigne, and he is the best player in Cuba, and he's been doing it for years. He's a big, strong guy, so with his bat speed and strength, he has the power to hit for average and to slug home runs, and he's a little aggressive, but you know, all that power gets him a lot of respect, so he makes up for all the swings and misses with plenty of balls, and he's a good sense of the strike zone. He's a decent fielder, you know, nothing special, it's passable, and he has an average to above average arm. Next up, we'll look at number four, Shintaro Fujinami. And unfortunately, Shohei Ohtani didn't participate this year, but if Ohtani is the best pitch in Japan, and he is, then Fujinami pretty much has the potential to be the second best. Fujinami, he's 22, he's always going to be living in Ohtani's shadow. So while his numbers don't exactly jump off the page at you, and they kind of seem a little disappointing when you look at it in the context of what Ohtani's done, Fujinami has still been pretty great with the Hanshin Tigers. His fastball sits in the mid-90s, and then there's potential for him to get a little bit more of a velocity bump as he gets a little older and enters into his prime. I mean, he's a big kid. His breaking ball and his splitter are both plus pitches, and then, you know, he also has a changeup, a forkball, a shooto pitch, and they're all good enough to be regularly mixed into his repertoire. So he's a guy that's probably, unfortunately for, you know, the Nippon professional baseball and people who like watching baseball in Japan, he's a guy that's probably going to be posted in a couple of years, so we'll probably see him in the MLB one day. Next up, number five, is Tomoyuki Sugano. And Sugano is really among the best pitchers in Japan as well. He's a little older than Ohtani and Fujinami, but he's also the ace of the Yomiuri Giants, so that counts as something in status. I mean, he voluntarily gave up a year in his career so that he could be drafted by the Giants, so that he could play for the Giants after he was drafted by the Fighters, who originally wanted him but didn't announce ahead of time that they were going to pick him. So he basically went back to college for a year and then was drafted by the Giants, who he wanted to play for. His fastball sits in the low to mid-90s. It's an effective pitch, but, you know, a couple of years ago, he had a fastball that really sat, you know, mid-90s. But he injured a ligament, so it's really a shadow of what he used to be. And he throws two curveballs, a kind of tight one that's around 80, and then a loopier one around 70 that are both swing and miss pitches. And in addition to, you know, basically having two really good pitches, he's a control artist. He has a really high ground ball rate, and because of that, he's also one of the best fielding pitchers in the country today. Number six is Tetsudo Yamada, and Yamada is the Yakult Swallows' best player, and arguably he's the best position player in Japan. He won the Central League MVP award in 2015, and since his breakout in 2014, you know, he's been basically a perennial 300 hitter, 30-plus home run guy, and then he also has speed, and he stole 30 more plus bases in the past 2 years. So pretty much, you know, middle infielders that are 30-30 guys, that's pretty attractive to any team. It's worth noting that Yamada plays in Meiji Jungo Park Stadium, which is a hitter-friendly park. And, you know, it's a rare outdoor stadium, and it's kind of windy there, and its dimensions are 320, 390, 320. But still, you know, Yamada's an exceptional hitter. Next up is Yoshitomo Tetsugo. And basically, he gets a lot of comparisons to Hideki Matsui. So if Hideki Matsui is Godzilla, then Tetsugo is Godzuki. Or maybe Mechagodzilla, because Godzuki is kind of dumb. And Mechagodzilla is kind of cool. But basically, the Baystars are a terrible team, and Tetsugo is their bright spot. He broke out in 2014 as a 22-year-old, and last season, 2016, he really turned it on when he led the entire Central League with 44 homers. He's a good hitter, too. You know, he can draw walks, and he could spray the ball at all fields. So he's not really, you know, just a one-dimensional swing, you know, true outcome player. He's not the best fielder, and he doesn't really add much to the base paths. But when you're a 300 hitter and you can hit over 40 home runs, you know, you don't need to be a good fielder, and you don't really need to add much on the base paths. Number 8 is Yang Jong Yang, and I wrote about him on Amazing Avenue proper in 2014 when he was posted. So if you want a more detailed look at his, you know, profile as a pitcher, you can go read it there. Basically, he throws a high 80s fastball, tops out around, you know, 90, 91, 92. And his slider is his best pitch overall, but he struggles to throw for strikes. So his MO is really to just set hitters up with his fastball and a changeup and then kind of get them fishing with the slider. Number 9, Daeho Lee. Daeho Lee, he signed with the Seattle Mariners last season, and he got a little bit of playing time, but he really didn't exactly impress. So he went back to Korea for the upcoming 2017 season, and he's going to be the highest paid athlete in the entire country. So, you know, good for him. He hit 14 home runs at the Mariners, but he didn't really do much else in terms of, you know, having a batting average or defense or whatever. So his playing time is kind of sporadic, and they just let him walk. He's still a talented player, though, and he'll probably put up real, you know, good numbers back in Korea. So again, good for him. He's making the money. He's getting playing time, and he's actually, his story is actually a little interesting. He's another guy that I wrote about on Amazing Avenue. So anyone who's interested, you can go back and read up on Daeho Lee. And the final guy is Vladimir Balentin, who played with the Kingdom of the Netherlands. He was drafted originally by the Mariners, and he didn't really get a lot of playing time because of a crowded outfield situation. So he's traded at the Reds. And once again, you know, crowded outfield situation, didn't get much playing time. So he opted to sign with the Yakult Swallows for the 2011 season. And in his first year there, he kind of struggled a little bit, but he did slug 31 homers, which led the Central League. He was a guy that his MO was always basically having power, and he could kind of get on base, which is why he was kind of attractive to the kind of sabermetric community back in the early to mid-2000s, whenever it was, when he was a prospect for the Mariners. But in 2012, then Balentin hit 31 home runs again, and he got a little more accustomed to the league, and he hit 272, 386, 572. It was his 2013 season, though, that was really his hallmark season. He won Central League MVP, which happens, but it's kind of rare for a foreigner, for a Gaijin, by hitting 330, 455, 779. But what was most impressive about that season, what made it literally one for the record books, was how many home runs he hit that year. In 130 games, he hit 60 home runs, which broke the prior record set by Sadaharu Oh, who was the Japanese home run king. And, you know, 60 home runs is an amazing accomplishment that most hitters don't ever sniff. But the fact that Valentin was able to actually do it makes it even more impressive, because that record was so protected by the baseball establishment in Japan. A couple of guys in the past, Randy Bass, Tuffy Rhodes, and Alex Cabrera, either came close or tied 0, but they basically weren't given the opportunity to break the record because they're constantly pitched around and, you know, intentionally walked. And because of that, it made O's record a little hollow, you know, at least to me, but, you know, it was what it was. But Ballantyne reached that 55 home run mark with basically 2 weeks of the season left. So Japanese pitchers, even if they wanted to, you know, really had no choice to pitch to him. You know, they're not going to intentionally walk a guy for 2 weeks straight. So, you know, besides for the 2015 season when he missed most of the year to injury, Ballantyne has been pretty much an automatic right-in for, you know, well above average batting average and at least 31 home runs. He's actually pretty machine-like in that regard. He's hit 31 home runs in all of his seasons except for his record-breaking, except for his injured season and his record-breaking 2013. So anyway, so that was, those are a bunch of guys that are, you know, players of note in leagues across the world. And that was the World Baseball Classic. It was fun, and we'll do it again in a couple of years. So this is Steve Saipa, and I will be talking with you guys next time.
Hi, it's Kate. I am back with the 2017 kickoff of the Panic City Meter. I'm sick, so apologize for my voice because it's gone from like 60 degrees to 20 degrees in 24 hours here, which is how one gets sick. I also apologize for having absolutely no idea what to tell you about this team. Because there's just, you know, we have a vague idea of probably your 25-man roster. You know, you're starting nine. It's going to be Reyes, it's going to be Cabrera, Cespedes, Granderson, Walker, Bruce, Duda, Darnold, / Rivera. You know, we know who's playing. I just have no idea how healthy they're going to be. And this is going to be an incredibly high variance team because if they all stay healthy and they all contribute like they could, like I would like them to, like they probably maybe should, this team could be really good. You know, Cespedes is probably going to be a sure thing. Granderson's looks good. Darnold looked good in spring training, which small sample size, spring training, whatever you want to say. He's been hitting the ball. And that is what we need from Travis Darnold, which, you know, really revolutionary analysis here. But Cabrera and Walker, if they can, you know, especially Walker with his back, if he can stay healthy. Lucas Duda gave us all a scare with the back thing, but he's looked pretty good. Jay Bruce, I just, guys, I don't know what to tell you anymore. So Jay Bruce, you know, let's just, I would like Jay Bruce to be good. I've seen people out there, you know, want him to fail so they have to bring up Conforto. We saw him failing last year and they still didn't bring up Conforto. So I don't know that that's really the choice here. I would like it to be. I would love it to be. We're stuck with Jay Bruce, I think. So who knows? I don't know what to tell you about Michael Conforto. He's going to slug 1,200 in Vegas and it's going to be embarrassing and glorious all at the same time. Reyes is very likely going to be your starting third baseman for most of the season. David Wright, who knows if he can play. He's trying, you know, not to cry here. It's going to be super sad watching David Wright not play all year. But Reyes can still play, you know. Baseball, we're going to say strictly on the field stuff. The signing of Reyes was a great move. It's worked out. He's cheap. He can still hit. Granderson hit two monster home runs yesterday. I was laughing out loud watching that spring training game. Doesn't mean anything again, but you know what you're getting from a lot of these guys. And if they stay healthy and productive, I think the offense is going to be fine. If one or two or three of them don't contribute or are on the DL for most of the year, then you're going to get things like a heck of a lot of Ty Kelly and TJ Rivera at bats. I like both of those guys, but let's, you know, if it comes to that, you've probably got some cause for concern. Rene Rivera, you've got your pitch framing metrics. I still don't do all of that stuff, but I get it. I get the appeal of him. Juan Lagares, if he can get back to the defensive standards that we know and love, and he can hit a bit, then that's going to be fine. That's what you need. You need him to hit enough. You don't need him, you know, Jose, you know, hitting UNCSBIT standards. We've seen him in it a bit. Wilmer Flores should be utilized as a platoon. We know Terry's not all that great at platoons and using players like they should be used. So, I don't know. It's like, again, it's such high variance. They could be great. They could be terrible. So, I guess I would like to say this is going to be a really fun season. It's probably just going to be a really stressful season, which is why we're all here. So, I guess I'll see you guys when we start.
Well, folks, that does it for another installment of Amazing Avenue Audio. Thank you so much for listening. We really do appreciate it. As a reminder, next week is our pigeon preview. So if you have any pigeon-related questions, please email the show, podcast@AmazingAvenueAudio.com, and we will talk about it. You can also go to AmazingAvenue.com and check out all sorts of writing ahead of the new season. We have previews for various players. We have projections. We have lots of fun stuff on there, so check it out. You may also find Amazing Avenue on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Amazing Avenue. If you wouldn't mind, if you would rate, review, and subscribe to the show in Stitcher and iTunes, in your podcatcher of choice. Those reviews and subscriptions really do matter. They help the show immensely. So thank you for doing that. We truly appreciate it. And you can follow all of our contributors on Twitter. Kate is at Kate E. Feldman. Steve is at Steve Sipa. I am at Brian Edenapp. Chris is at Chris McShane. And we will be back next week with the pitching preview. So thank you so much. And until next time, let's go Mets.